Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think Luther felt he could only do, well, I mean, it comes back to that phrase I quoted earlier that he's meant to have said at the Diet of Worms, and we're not sure if he said it, "Here I stand, I can do no other." I think Luther felt he could only do what he could do, really. And if he read Scripture and that's what Scripture told him to do, and if he felt that God somehow was acting through him, he couldn't be too compromising. I think there was an element of compromise in what he was wanting to do. And I think he certainly felt driven, he certainly felt chosen, but I don't think that makes him the kind of inflexible egotist that people present him as. He is a very, very complex man. He says contradictory things quite often during his life, and as I've said already, he has these extraordinary ups and downs. So, you know, in his latter years, you will constantly read every couple of months, he has a spiritual collapse and takes to his bed and says he's about to die and meet God in heaven. And no one quite knows what to do, and then he recovers. And it seems to me those aren't perhaps spiritual collapses, but those are kind of emotional and psychological collapses.
Every man must do two things alone. He must do his own believing and his own dying. The powerful and resolute words of German theologian, monk, philosopher and writer Martin Luther. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the life and enduring legacy of the great Martin Luther, possibly the most fearless man of the 16th century. The man who boldly nailed 95 theses, or his disputation on the power of indulgences, to the doors of the Castle Church at Wittenberg, a daring action that set off the Protestant Reformation and much more besides. This evening, I'm joined by journalist, historian and biographer Peter Stanford, whose compelling new biography, Martin Luther, Catholic Dissident, has just been published by Hodder & Staunton, where Peter writes, "Luther is one of those individuals who explains why the world is as it is now. His biography is not just for believers of whatever denomination, but for all who want to understand how he arrived at the state we're in." So who was Martin Luther? What did he believe in? And how did one man change the world?
Hello, my name is Peter Stanford, and I am a writer based in London. My new book is about Martin Luther, this being the 500th anniversary of the start of the Reformation. Previously, I've written, in general terms, around books around religious themes, about the kind of culture, the history, the impact of religion on its own time and also on our own time. So I've written a book about Judas, I wrote a book about Pope Joan, the female pope, I wrote a book about the devil even.
Really well done on the biography of Martin Luther, Peter. It's an astonishingly interesting read. I wasn't too sure how I felt about Martin Luther at start, and I certainly warmed to him as I progressed through the biography, which I really wasn't expecting to do, because he was presented, certainly as when I was a schoolgirl, as quite a formidable, angry, somewhat negative type of a character. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and we can see where we take it from. Martin Luther wrote that everything that is done in the world is done by hope. Do you agree with that? Can we apply that to Martin Luther?
In terms of Martin Luther, obviously I've spent my whole life feeling hopeful, but in terms of Martin Luther, I think I know what he's getting at, but I think we could probably be a bit more precise about it. There were two things that I think drove Martin Luther on. One was he believed absolutely and completely that God was guiding him. Certainly from 1517 onwards, when he publishes the 95 Theses, he believes that he's doing what God tells him. And he describes it at one time as he's a bit like a horse in blinkers. You know, when horses run, they put the things over the horse's eyes to make sure it keeps on course. And he sees himself very much in that way. So some people sometimes say about him, oh, he had to be right all the time. He was an egotist. He wouldn't admit that he was wrong. And, you know, that's one way of looking at him. But I think a better way of looking at him is this was a man who believed God was guiding him. The other thing, perhaps not hope, but courage. And one of the things I think is absolutely extraordinary about Martin Luther, reading about him now, 500 years on, is just his sheer courage in what he was doing. If you look at the theology of what he was suggesting, the reforms he was suggesting to the way the Catholic Church ran itself, to its theology, there isn't a single one of them that is new. Other people had said most of those things beforehand. And a lot of the people who'd said those things beforehand had been burnt at the stake for doing it, had been persecuted, had been hounded, had been burnt at the stake. And for Martin Luther, that was a very, very real prospect. And so here you have it, this monk from a fairly obscure bit of Germany, sort of central Germany, kind of rural area, taught at what was effectively a new university, not one of the famous universities. He was this obscure German monk. And he was challenged. He took on the Catholic Church. He took on the power of Rome. And we're not talking about Europe as we know it now, with, you know, different denominations split into different parts. At that stage, late medieval Catholicism had an iron grip over the whole of Europe, worked very much hand in hand with the rulers of late medieval Europe. So that division we think of nowadays between the secular and the religious, between the state and the church, none of that existed. So he was effectively taking on the entire European system from this very, very humble base. And again, you can call it arrogance, you can call it foolishness, but I'm constantly amazed, really, by his courage in doing it. And he never flinches. So they give him various opportunities to back down, to you know, play nice, to make a nice compromise, and they'll somehow get round it. And he won't do it. And you know, the very famous words that are associated with him, it's not entirely clear if he said them. His final chance to recant was at the Diet of Worms. It was a very odd thing. So diet is a kind of meeting of German princes as opposed to something you eat. And Worms, or Worms, as they'd say in Germany, is a German city. So at the Diet of Worms in 1521, he was given the chance finally to back down or to pay with his life. And he is by repute meant to have said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And it's just, I think, phenomenal courage. And I think that's the thing that comes over very strongly when you're considering his life. And I suppose what I wanted to do in this book was, you know, I grew up in went to a Christian Brothers school in Birkenhead, and so full might of the Catholic Church that told me Martin Luther was a very bad man and spoilt everything. And then, you know, when you go forward and you read more about him, I think his image nowadays is very much as this kind of rather dour, devil-obsessed medieval figure. He talked a lot about his bowels all the time. He was very angry. He was very disruptive. He was uncompromising. And he seems a fairly unattractive figure and who belongs almost to the history books. But when you actually start reading about Martin Luther's life, it is actually very, very different. He wasn't, as portrayed, a kind of man intent on disrupting things. He was a man on a mission, really, a man who could see how things could be done better. And actually, most of the things that he thought could be done better, I don't think any of us would disagree with. And I suppose that brings me to the other point about him, which he is entirely relevant to 2017, as he was to 1517, in the sense what he was talking about was individual conscience and the individual standing before God. And of course, all those ideas that he put forward in the Reformation then get caught up in the Enlightenment, in the idea of human liberty, freedom of religion, freedom to either, you know, embrace religion or turn away from it, and I suppose human rights. So he is absolutely one of the makers of the Europe that we live in.
You describe his life as crowded, controversial, but compelling. He clearly was a very courageous character, explosive, but also quite compassionate and generous. He's a very complex man. But I'm just wondering, do you think we can describe him as a hero or a prophet? Because he changed the world, effectively.
I think we can certainly see him as a hero. And I say this as a kind of nice Catholic boy who still goes to church. I think the grip that medieval Catholicism had over Europe at that time was pretty destructive in many ways. And I think it needed challenging and it needed to change. And, you know, you could argue that the only reason that we still have the Catholic Church with us nowadays is because it was forced to change by Luther and sort of clean up its act up to a point. And obviously over 500 years it's got better at doing that in some aspects or other aspects where it really still has a lot of work to do. So he really changed that, and I think he also changed the whole kind of political setup of Europe in terms of, you know, this late medieval idea that that there was no line between church and state. There was no line between the power of the papacy, of the bishops and of rulers and princes and all of those things. He changes that. And I suppose the other thing he was doing as well, and one of the reasons when we have to think about why was he successful when other people who'd said very similar things weren't successful, he was successful because he absolutely captured the mood of the moment. That there was a huge kind of economic and social discontent in the kind of poorer classes, certainly in his native Germany and across Europe, and he tapped into that. You know, it's interesting thinking about him at this very moment in our own history, because, you know, we've seen the rise of populist movements and of people who tap into discontent, whether it be the Brexit vote in Britain or it be Donald Trump in the United States. Martin Luther was a populist. He was a man of the people. He spoke the people's language. He talked to them in kind of rough street language rather than sort of highfalutin Latin. And of course, famously translated the Bible into German. So he actually gave people the word of God as opposed to them having to listen to clerics telling them what the word of God was. But he was a popularist. And he rode on a wave of popular discontent in what he was doing. So he was sort of anti-establishment, and I think the world needs overturning from time to time. It needs to think afresh. I'm not saying that to say I approve of Donald Trump, but I'm saying it because you can't just keep going on and keep going on the way things are. Someone has to challenge that, and someone has to address the reason why people felt so discontented with the church at that particular period. And Luther was the one who did it. I mean, interestingly, if you think in terms of reputations, and I spoke before about how Luther's reputation in many senses is as a rather dour, dusty, disagreeable character. And of course, the person from that very same period that we all love now in Europe is Erasmus, the Dutch scholar Erasmus, who's meant to be very clever and very witty and very, you know, kind of likable and very modern. You know, he's the one with the reputation, but it was Luther who challenged the corruption of the Catholic Church. It was Luther who identified the problems. It was Luther who looked at the abuse of papal authority. I mean, at its simplest, what he was saying was that the church could only insist on things that were in the Bible. And that so much of what medieval Catholicism did, was based on its own tradition. So a very simple example, Luther said there were only really two sacraments, baptism and Eucharist, because they are the only two that are there, certainly in the New Testament, Jesus baptized by John the Baptist, and the Last Supper for Eucharist. All the other ones, so confession, marriage, confirmation, priesthood, holy orders, extreme unction, all of those things, marriage as well, they were not sacraments. They were not a way to God. They were simply a kind of a tradition of the church. So he brought a kind of purity to things as well that, again, drew in this audience.
Do you think, though, we would have had a Reformation if we didn't have Luther? You said moments ago that, you know, there's an inevitability within it. So I'm just wondering, if it wasn't Luther, would it have been somebody else giving us a type of Reformation on some form of some similar theoretical line?
Yes, I'm sure change had to come, and change was going to come. And I think what you have to do in thinking about Luther is look at the people who were around him at the time. Erasmus in Holland was prodding the Catholic Church from within and saying it had to be more sort of compassionate, more thoughtful, less rigid. But you know, when the going got tough, Erasmus ran off to Switzerland. He didn't push the point. If you look at some of the other reformers who came along, Zwingli in Switzerland comes along very soon after Luther, and he is rather keen on fighting on the battlefield and gets killed on the battlefield. You then move on to Calvin, and obviously Calvinism, again, changes the face of Europe, but you only have Calvinism because you had Luther. So you can set him alongside other people and say, yes, reform was going to happen, it was going to be one of these people, but you can't take away from him that he was the one who actually made it happen. Everyone else aspired, and he made it happen.
He said something on the lines of, "I am freer now that I know the Pope is an Antichrist." And I think he also stated that when I am angry, I can pray well and preach well. Do you think anger and that sense of hostility and rage against the church at that time really motivated him? It was central to who and what he was and how he lived in the world. That kind of sense of frustration, anger, and almost battle with the world.
Anger is very, very key with Luther, and it goes to the very heart of his personality. So Luther was a man who flew into great rages, but he tended to see his rages as very constructive. So another of the things that he said, and I'm slightly paraphrasing, is that, you know, he could only really write when he was angry. He couldn't do it when he was feeling kind of more relaxed. And actually, if you look at the trajectory of his life, most of his great writings come between 1517, when he wrote the 95 Theses, and about 1525, all the key documents in terms of the Reformation come from that. In 1525, he gets married to Katharina von Bora, and actually that seems to calm him down rather, the kind of love of a good woman. Don't all priests need it, really? But that calms him down, and you get less of that anger coming through. And I think one of the questions you have to ask about Luther is his mental health, I'm afraid. I mean, I mean that in kind of kind ways. But, you know, he clearly had the sort of personality that went from great highs down to great depths as well. And you see that continually through his life. I mean, what it's called at the time is a kind of spiritual crisis. But I think, in you know, looking at it in 21st century terms, we would see that more as a kind of mental and psychological crisis. So the anger thing is very, very important. And, you know, when you look at the 95 Theses, which is what we'll be remembering on the 31st of October this year, that's when he published them, you know, they are very angry. So some of them are perfectly reasonably put and perfectly reasonable questions to ask the church about its practices, principally around this idea of indulgences, which was the idea that the church, if you paid a visiting preacher a sum of money, you could guarantee yourself a place in heaven. Now, Luther said, perfectly reasonably, I would say, that the only person who decides who goes into heaven and who doesn't is God, and the church can't be sort of double-guessing God and making money out of it. So he says those things, and he says them very reasonably. But, of course, you quoted the line about the Antichrist. He very quickly, his rhetoric, even within the 95 Theses, starts kind of revving up, and he uses these very cutting phrases. One of the things, again, talking of contemporary parallels, I think is very interesting with Luther, is he was a man who used the social media of his day. Now, clearly, he wasn't tweeting, and he wasn't on his phone all the time. But the rise of Luther coincides very much with the rise of the printing presses in Germany. And so what happened with all of Luther's key pronouncements, the ones that were most vehemently against the Catholic Church and what it was doing, was they were passed to local printers who would make pamphlets out of them and posters out of them. And importantly, because this was an age of widespread illiteracy, they would use illustrations on them as well, a bit like kind of storybooks for children, or with getting his message across. And what we do know about Luther is no sooner had he said something or he'd come out with some angry riposte to the Catholic Church, then those details were spreading around, first of all around Germany and circulating, and then beyond Germany into Switzerland, into France, into Italy, and ultimately to Rome. So his message was spreading much wider than a message would ever have spread beforehand, because he used these kind of new means of communication, and that made him much more potent. And in a way, that explains why an obscure monk from an obscure corner of Germany brought down or brought to its knees the Catholic Church, because previously that wouldn't have happened. You know, he could have written something angry and it would have taken, you know, 5 weeks for it to be delivered to the next town by horseback. So, you know, that's absolutely key to it as well. But the anger is key too, because it's the way he phrases things all the time. He doesn't say, "Well, I think I quite disagree with the Pope." He says, "No, the Pope is absolutely wrong. The Pope is in league with the devil. The Pope is the Antichrist." He uses street language, the kind of things that people will understand, and that taps into discontent.
It's without a doubt hugely impressive, though, anyone who can take on the big boys, whether it's powerful elites, businesses, church authorities, whatever it is, that they can be that single-minded and have that self-belief to drive change, isn't it? I'm just wondering, what do you think he would have made of the Catholic Church today and all the issues facing it. Because he was looking at issues around celibacy and sexuality, and a lot of stuff that's very pertinent to today and some of the problems the church faces.
Well, let's be careful about the sexuality. He wasn't particularly interested in sexuality. He thought sexuality was something good and to be encouraged. He absolutely didn't go along with that Catholic idea of separating body and soul. He saw them all as one. But you're absolutely right in that what he was saying. So if you look at if you look at some of the things that he proposed, so one of the things he wanted was that authority be delegated down from Rome to local bishops, to local churches. The German church at the time felt it was very exploited by Rome and had no say in what happened. That's precisely what Pope Francis is saying at the moment. Another of the things that Luther was very, very strong on was that the way the Catholic Church operated in Rome was corrupt. There was a lot of corruption there, a lot of money spent on things it shouldn't be spent on, a lot of things going on there that you know, weren't as they should be. He went there in 1510 and was rather horrified by what he saw. What is Pope Francis doing at the moment? He's cleaning out the Vatican Curia, which is something Luther would absolutely have approved of. What else did Luther want? Luther wanted he wanted the Bible to be available to all of us so we could read it in our own language, not say it was kind of in Latin and different from us. He wanted the Mass to be in the vernacular, in the language of that country. That came in 1969. Obviously, the Catholic Church took a very long time to take notice of what he was saying. We now have the Mass in the vernacular. He believed that priests should be married. He had no problem at all. In fact, he felt that priests should be married, that actually a celibate priesthood wasn't a good idea. That is slowly happening. We have married priests in the Catholic Church now, and I would say the pressure for that is building to such an extent that that will be conceded at some stage. I mean, it's not such a huge change. We have to remember that for the first 11 or 1200 years of the Catholic Church, we did have married priests. St. Peter, the first pope, was married. We know that because it's in the Gospels. So he was touching on all of these things. I mean, there are things where the Catholic Church would still disagree. As I've said already, he believed there should be two sacraments, not seven. So there were areas in which they disagree. But the most profound thing, and I came across this when I was researching the book, is if you look back, and some people listening will remember the Second Vatican Council, and certainly as someone who grew up in the post-Second Vatican Council era, this very, very resonant phrase of the Second Vatican Council, that we were all told that there was no longer a division between clergy and laity, that we were all the people of God, that because we were all baptized believers, we could consider ourselves priests in a very broad sense. And that's one of the things that's really kept me inside the Catholic Church, because obviously, you know, sometimes the clergy aren't as appealing as they could be in the way that they run things and the decisions that they take. Luther said that. Luther said that in 1520. So when the Second Vatican Council talks about the priesthood of baptized believers, that's something that Luther had said in 1520. They are actually echoing his words. So if he came back today, if he was a kind of Doctor Who figure and could somehow be a time traveler, I suspect he'd be rather comfortable within the Catholic Church. He wouldn't be thinking about leaving.
You write, to grasp the extent of Luther's rebellion at a distance of 500 years requires a leap of the imagination. He's clearly one of the greatest personalities or characters of the 16th century. But within all of that, I'm just wondering, do you think history in some way has been unkind to him or has not fully reckoned with all he had to offer?
I think history has spent a great deal of time looking at him. Arguably, there is nobody who has had more books written about him in the last 500 years than Martin Luther. So I'm just the latest in a very, very, very long line.
But have they got him, though?
Well, I think they probably might. Well, I think they might have got him in the past, but for in the 400 years, 450 years almost since Luther's death. You basically have the Catholic Church and the Lutherans, or the Protestants, as they became more broadly, at each other's throats. So they both had an interest in either painting him as a kind of plaster saint almost on the Protestant side, or painting him as the kind of the seven-headed serpent from the Book of Revelation, which is what Catholicism did. I mean, there was nothing that they wouldn't say about him. They suggested his poor mother was a prostitute at one stage. And all of these things were still being said at the beginning of the 20th century. So a lot of disinformation on both sides in all of these things. But I think one of the problems with getting Luther now is that we live in, particularly in Western Europe, we live in fairly sceptical, secular times. And in order to grasp Luther, there are three things you have to understand about Luther in order to kind of grasp his importance. One is to look at the kind of the theology that he put forward, and this phrase that everyone that is sort of associated with him, justification by faith alone. And I think most people nowadays have absolutely no idea what that means. And really, in very simple terms, it was you know, what decision God would make when you turned up at the gates of heaven, whether you could get in or not. But those ideas have become relatively alien in a 21st century society that isn't particularly religiously literate. So that bit confuses them about Luther. And then you move on to his personality, and some of the most famous things we know about him is that, you know, he threw an inkwell at the devil, that he was constantly writing about how he saw the devil as a very real and living thing around him. I mean, he even thought the devil was so real that Luther all his life had terrible problems with constipation, that he thought the devil possessed his bowels. And you read that and you think, God, he's some sort of medieval creep, this whole idea about a kind of real devil and all illness being down to the devil. That feels very, very odd and not of our times. And of course, when you get onto the politics of the situation, which is the third aspect that is really important to understand with Luther, it was a Europe that we really don't recognize at all. This was a Europe where the Catholic Church had a stranglehold over not only religious life, but over politics. You didn't have a place called Germany. You had the Holy Roman Empire, which was a jigsaw of tiny little states with kind of priests and archbishops in charge of them. And the rise of the nation state, of nationalism, which so, even in an age of the European Union, so shapes the Europe that we live in nowadays, none of those things existed. So I think one of the problems for a 21st century audience is to kind of understand where Luther is coming from and to drop him in some sort of context that we understand. I mean, even in very, very simple terms, you know, Luther wants to change the Mass, Luther wants to change the sacraments. So what I feel you have to do in a book about Luther written in 2017 is you have to explain to people what the sacraments are. You have to explain to people what Mass is. When we say that the Catholic Church excommunicated him, we have to explain what that means now, because I don't think a modern audience necessarily understands all of these things now. And once you can clear those confusing things to one side, it brings you back to this character of Luther, this extraordinarily charismatic man. Let's not worry about the kind of dusty dourness. He must have had extraordinary charisma when he stood in the pulpit, that people followed him in such huge numbers. What was it about him? And you look at the famous portrait of him, and he looks a bit jowly and a bit odd in his kind of floppy black cap.
He's not the best looking, sure, he's not.
But you see, if you look at some early portraits of him, he had these incredibly piercing eyes. He was a bit more chiseled then. He obviously had a bit later on. What was it about him that made him cut through all those other things and for people to be prepared to follow him and to die for him? There was something about him. So one of the things that I do in the book is from about 1530 onwards, and he died in 1546, he would talk. He lived in what had been the Augustinian cloister in Wittenberg, so when all the monks had gone, that became his family home with his wife, Katharina von Bora, who was an ex-nun, and they had six or seven children, but they'd have lodgers there. And at the table every evening, he would sit and talk about himself, and a lot of these things were recorded. And it's not quite as good as a recording that you'd make in a radio studio, but you get a sense of his voice and his intonation and how he would put things himself, that earthiness about him, and the sort of dark sense of humour about him. So what I've tried to do with the book is kind of just bring him alive into three dimensions in the book, as opposed to him being this cog in a wheel of European history, of religious history, of someone who belongs 500 years ago. There's something about him that has an appeal for our own age.
You argue that he was no pragmatist. Should we be bothered whether he actually nailed the 95 theses to the castle door at Wittenberg? Because whether it happened at that time or not, or roughly, you know, it's all very patchy, isn't it? But does it actually really matter?
I don't think those details matter, no, not at all. So just to be clear what we're talking about. So the story goes that on the 31st of October 1517, Luther nailed these 95 theses. Theses are kind of debating points. So they were things that he thought were wrong with the church. The story is that he nailed them to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg, which is where he was teaching at the university there. Now, nowhere in any of Luther's own writings, and there are so many of his writings still with us that they stretch stretched to 121 volumes in the Weimar Library in Germany. Nowhere in those 121 volumes will you ever find him talking about nailing anything to a door. The story arose after his death and was put about by the people around him. What we do know is that if anyone was going to attach anything to a door, then they would have attached it by wax. But I think each of these 95 theses are about three, four sentences long. Just think about it. How long are 95 sets of four sentences going to be? I mean, this wasn't like a little petition he nailed to the door. It would have been like hanging wallpaper all over the door. No, what we absolutely know happens, and this is much more important than whether he nailed them, waxed them, or put them in the post or whatever, is that he wrote the 95 theses and he sent them to his local archbishop. And he said these were things that he wanted a debate about in the church. And the archbishop, rather than dismissing him and rather than thinking, oh, I'm just going to have a little chat with him and buy him off, or I'll stop a bit of this indulgence selling and nothing will happen, the archbishop decided to send them to Rome for the Vatican's view. And then the Vatican came back with its view. And rather than take seriously what Luther was saying, they dismissed him. They said, oh, all Germans are drunk, or all, you know, friars are all about having arguments with other monks or whatever. We're not going to take any of this seriously. And throughout the next 5 or 6 years, they just kept dismissing him as if he was a bit beneath, as if he was beneath contempt. It was a bit like a player from the lowest level of the football league had suddenly appeared on the pitch with the Premier League players and said, "Let me play with you, boys." And they were all saying, "No, you're not good enough." And in a sense, that's what enabled Luther to touch a nerve with the disenfranchised. So those details about whether it was nailed or not are not important. I mean, some of the details that we know about his story or that have gone down in his legend are important to think about. So another of the legends is this idea that why did he become a monk in 1505? Because he'd previously been studying law. And as the story was told, he was out walking one day and there was a thunderstorm and he was so frightened of being struck by lightning that he promised St. Anne, the mother of the Virgin Mary, that if he survived the thunderstorm, didn't get struck by thunder, he would go into a monastery. Now, again, if you start picking away at that story, it just isn't true. And I think what often a lot of famous men do, or men who are particularly good preachers, good speakers, good orators, is they shape their own life story to give it a kind of a rhetorical power. And I think that was true of Luther. But I think the important thing isn't whether those stories are true or not. It's whether people believed them, whether they acted upon them, and whether this mass uprising virtually swept away the Catholic Church in northern Germany and then spread across Europe in different forms. They're the important things.
He'd very strong views on money, and he said money is Satan's scripture through which he works in the world. And he also said money cannot quiet hunger, but on the contrary, it is the cause of hunger. Irrespective of your views of Satan and all the rest, they're fairly progressive, aren't they?
They are. They chime very well with the 21st century in lots of ways, in a sort of anti-capitalism. But actually, the other way to look at them is that Luther was... I've talked about how some of his ideas were very modern and very resonant in our own age. But this idea of kind of the hating the money economy was very much of the time of late medieval Europe. Because what you have in Europe from the 14th century onwards, starting out in northern Italy, is you have the rise of a kind of what we would call a capitalist economy, where you have merchant bankers, who of course were merchants, who ran a bank in their shop and started selling goods. What is changing is you're losing the old barter system, where, you know, if you wanted some food from someone, you would give them milk from your cow or whatever, and the introduction of a kind of money economy. And that was one of the big causes of social discontent, certainly in the German lands at that time and across Europe. And I think Luther's rhetoric of not really liking the money economy was part and parcel of his appeal. But you have to be a bit careful about that. And you have to remember that Luther's parents, while absolutely not rich, he came from a kind of yeoman farmer stock, had enough money to pay for his education. And then he went straight from his education into a monastery where he never had to worry about money. So Luther was a bit unworldly in that sense. He never really had to bother much with money. And it was only when he got married to Katharina von Bora and started having children, having to feed them and pay the bills, that money really kind of, darkened his doorstep. And I'm afraid in that moment he decided he still didn't want anything to do with it. And he left poor Katharina to deal with all of that. And she was a pretty shrewd businesswoman herself. So he wasn't entirely anti-capitalist. He lived off the fruits of his wife's labour.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm joined by writer, journalist and biographer Peter Stanford, whose books include The Devil, a Biography, Heaven, a Traveller's Guide to the Undiscovered Country, Why I'm Still a Catholic, and Judas, the Troubling History of the Renegade Apostle. In Martin Luther, Catholic Dissident, Peter Stanford writes, how Martin Luther attached the thesis is the least of the many practical concerns raised by the traditional story of Luther's public declaration of rebellion. Even with his uncompromising nature, would he really have posted such a challenge to the sales of indulgences on the doors of the church, hours before it would be opened in an annual ceremony where money was taken in lieu of the remission of sins? It would have set Luther on a collision course with the patron of the university where he worked. Peter goes on to argue, to describe the Reformation as fueled by social and economic discontent is to present only a partial picture. I put it to Peter, did Martin Luther actually think his actions through? Did he plan to set up a new church? Or was that something that just happened?
Absolutely not. I think you're absolutely right in that he was driven. He felt that God was driving him forward, that he had this hotline to God in a way. And obviously other people in history have thought that as well, and it's led them to do extraordinary things, either good or bad. And you know, one has to be very nervous of all of that. But that is certainly what he felt. What Martin Luther wanted was for the Catholic Church to reform itself. He had no ambition when he started out with the 95 Theses in 1517 to overturn the church and set up his own church. And it was only as the Catholic Church progressively refused really to kind of engage with him in a debate. I mean, there were various set piece debates. There was a debate at Leipzig. There was a debate at the Diet of Augsburg. And then finally, the big set piece at the Diet of Worms in 1521. But what the Catholic Church kept saying all the time, it never sort of said, oh, you've got a point on some of these issues that you're raising, Martin. It basically said, no, the Pope is in charge. The Pope decides. And whatever you think is worthless, because the Pope is the only person who can decide. And of course, what Luther said was only Scripture could decide. You had to. So whenever they came back and dismissed what he'd said, you have to go back to Scripture. Show me where in the Gospels Jesus says we should have marriage. Show me where Jesus says in the Gospels that priests should be a group set apart who are treated as special. So he was challenging in all those sense. And what he wanted was, and it's really clear reading the later years of his life in the 1540s, he dies in 1546, that he is still hopeful somehow that the Catholic Church will come round to some form of agreement. Now, he's often portrayed as absolutely uncompromising, but two things to bear in mind when that is said. In 1530 was really the last great chance of healing this schism, there was a gathering with the Emperor Charles V, all the princes and bishops of Germany, papal representatives, and Lutheran representatives. Luther himself, because his life was in danger, didn't actually go to the meeting, but he drafted the script that was used there. And what the Lutheran, it's called the Augsburg Confession, the Lutheran position, it didn't push the point of papal authority. It left it out of its sort of, you know, laying out its case. They were still prepared to compromise. He was looking for compromise then at that stage, and carried on for the last 15 years of his life, trying to find a way in which this could be made better. And yes, after he is excommunicated, and because so many churches follow him, individual churches, individual pastors, individual congregations follow him, he starts sort of running his own church network in a way, and setting out his own rules about whether priests can marry and all of those details. But he runs it very much as a church within a church. Never at any stage in his life does Martin Luther say, I've left the Catholic Church now. I'm setting up on my own. This is my own business in modern terms. He never, ever says that. And it takes him. So he starts setting up his own parallel church within a church in 1522, and it's only in 1541, so 20 years later, that he appoints his first bishop without Rome say so, and there's only the one of them. So he's leaving the door open always, and that's why the subtitle of my book is Catholic Dissident, because I feel very strongly that Martin Luther was informed by his Catholic perspective all the way through that he wanted to remain a Catholic, and indeed he died a Catholic.
So he's a spacious Catholic, is that what you're arguing?
Well, he's an excommunicated Catholic, but of course the whole point of excommunication, as the Church teaches it, is not that you are beyond the pale, because obviously what excommunication can never do is revoke your baptism, but what it can do is you're sort of like a suspended member almost, and the whole point of excommunication is to give you a necessary nudge. So you think very hard about what you've done and you make amends and you rejoin the flock.
Wriggling back on your knees, Peter.
He would never do that. That was part of the problem. He wanted to be treated like a... I mean, they treated him with such contempt for so long. I think he wanted them to treat him seriously and to listen seriously to what he was saying, because there was a great deal of popular support for what he was saying.
You reference a very curious passage from his diaries. It was a few days before he died on the 16th of February, 1546. And Martin Luther wrote something on the lines of, "We cannot do what everyone wants, but we can do well what we want." It's a very interesting life philosophy and very, very focused. I'm just wondering, what's your take on it all? How do you understand it?
I think Luther felt he could only do, well, I mean, it comes back to that phrase I quoted earlier that he's meant to have said at the Diet of Worms, and we're not sure if he said it, "Here I stand, I can do no other." I think Luther felt he could only do what he could do, really. And if he read Scripture, and that's what Scripture told him to do, and if he felt that God somehow was acting through him, he couldn't be too compromising. I think there was an element of compromise in what he was wanting to do. And I think he certainly felt driven, he certainly felt chosen, but I don't think that makes him the kind of inflexible egotist that people present him as. He is a very, very complex man. He says contradictory things quite often during his life, and as I've said already, he has these extraordinary ups and downs. So, you know, in his latter years, you will constantly read every couple of months, he has a spiritual collapse and takes to his bed and says he's about to die and meet God in heaven. And no one quite knows what to do, and then he recovers. And it seems to me those aren't perhaps spiritual collapses, but those are kind of emotional and psychological collapses. So, you know, he says different things at different times. And I suppose a very good example, and one of the few things about Luther that people do know nowadays, is his attitude towards the Jews. So right at the very end of his life, in one of these dark moments, Luther writes this absolutely revolting tract about Jewish people, where he encourages Christians to go in and burn down synagogues. And the reason that he did that, I'm not excusing it in any way, shape or form. Let me be absolutely clear. It was revolting anti-Semitic prejudice. But the reason he did it was because he thought, because God was guiding him, that the Jews would necessarily want to convert to Christianity, that somehow they would hear God's voice in all of this. If you go back, so that document was written, and I think, in about 1544. If you go back to the 1520s, Luther was writing rather permissive documents about the Jews at that stage. So his views change on different things. His views harden as he gets older and he's disappointed. So it's hard to know where he stands. And of course, on the Jewish thing, a lot of people in Germany at the moment are saying they shouldn't be making such a big deal out of the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses because of this anti-Semitic link in Luther. And the Nazis in particular in the 1930s made great play of Luther as a kind of great German patriot and hero. They went to the Black Cloister in Wittenberg and decked it in Nazi flags. So he was used in Nazi propaganda, and some people feel that's put a question mark over Luther. But I think you've got to appreciate the times they were living in and the complexity of this man. He's a very, very complex character, which, I mean, I would say, and of course I would say this, wouldn't I, it makes it a really interesting biography, because you get under his skin and you see how unpredictable he could be and how angry he could be and how he could react. And then the next minute, after being angry and firing off the most revolting sort of angry text full of expletives, he would write the sort of beautiful poetic words that are in the hymns that he left behind, or he'd write a really kind of considered tract about Christian love or whatever. He's impossible to pin down, but I would argue endlessly fascinating.
And you argue that he's a very difficult figure to like. He was clearly quite depressive, unbending, very kind of a gloomy kind of a character and very punitive. I'm just wondering, are we better off with him or without him? Because he has such an extraordinary legacy. A lot of it is very controversial. But he argued, you know, for freedom of conscience. He's a great figure for hope and courage.
Yeah. And we don't get to choose who we have or who we don't have in history. But what we need to do is kind of understand what their significance is. And of course, one of the things that we constantly do with figures in history is we write them up and we write them down as the mood takes us. I would argue that in a Europe where human rights, where individual liberty, where freedom of conscience, freedom, you know, one of the things that Luther was promoting was the idea that each believer. One of the reasons he gave every German or made available to every German a copy of the Bible in their own language so they could read it and make their own decisions. Now, amongst the own decisions that you can make having read it is that you want nothing to do with God at all. And they were the things that Luther was offering people. He was putting those views forward. And I think they're absolutely key to the values that we live by nowadays. So I'm really glad he articulated those things. I mean, I think had he come back in the 18th century and seen how the Enlightenment philosophers were sort of picking up on those ideas and exploiting the fact that the stranglehold of Catholicism over Europe had been broken, he might have been rather horrified. I think he was a man who had one foot in his own age, in the late medieval age, and one foot in a sort of rather in the future, one foot in something rather more modern. So again, it's not straightforward. But, you know, don't you think as you go through life and you meet people that I certainly feel this as I get older, that people get more and more complicated and more fascinating to me. Whereas in the past, I used to kind of make very black and white judgments and think, oh, they're this or they're that. As I get older, I think, oh, then that's really fascinating. I can do those two things simultaneously. And that's why we need to look at Luther as well, because he does all sorts of contradictory things simultaneously. And he's just fascinating.
So for anyone who says he's not relevant and we shouldn't be celebrating the 500 years or marking the anniversary, what do you say to that? Get stuffed?
I say to them, if he hadn't done that, where would we be in Europe, really? I mean, I think a Reformation might have come, but it might have come in a very different format. It may have come with very different ideas. If you look at the ideas of Zwingli, of Calvin, of people who came afterwards, they were much harder line in a way. I mean, one of the interesting things with Luther is that you have this Protestant Reformation. He never liked the word Protestant because it was used against him, so it was protest. So people were calling, the Catholics were calling them all protests, so they were the Protestants, the people who protested. If you look at some of those other Protestant reformers who come afterwards, they're much more hardline. They're much more divisive. They're much more, you're kind of with us or you're against us. Again, with looking at the Lutheran Church as it exists nowadays, it's pretty much sits in the middle of the Christian spectrum in a kind of rather attractive way. And I think had other reformers tried to, made this breach in the dam almost, it might have turned out very differently. I think we were rather fortunate that it was Martin Luther who did it.
That was journalist, historian and biographer Peter Stanford. Martin Luther, Catholic Dissident is published by Hodder & Stoughton and retails for in around €13 in paperback. I have to say, hats off to Peter. This is a very accessible portrait of a hugely complex man. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brunock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end this evening's broadcast with the hopeful words of Martin Luther, who stated, "Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would fall to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree." Hopeful words indeed. Good night. Thank you.
Tracks on News Talk 106 to 108.